to the dollar in foreign trade, Bloomberg reported. By establishing a new settlements mechanism, the BRICS countries can reduce their dependence on the US dollar and increase their initiative and flexibility in foreign trade. Hong Yong, an expert at the Digital Real Economies Integration Forum 50, told the Global Times recently. One way is to use their national currencies as a means of settlement in mutual trade. Hong said, as such, an alternative payment system can reduce transaction costs and further facilitate trade and investment among BRICS countries. Experts said that BRICS countries need to further strengthen their monetary policy coordination, establish a stable financial supervision mechanism, and strengthen financial cooperation and technical support. In addition, the BRICS countries need to create more open, transparent, and reliable financial markets and attract more countries to join and adopt the BRICS payment system. In recent years, the influence and attractiveness of the BRICS mechanism has been on the rise, and it has increasingly become an important platform for cooperation among developing economies, experts said. According to data provided by Acorn Macro Consulting, a UK-based macroeconomic research firm, the BRICS bloc accounts for 31.5% of global GDP, surpassing the G7, which currently accounts for just 30.7%. More than 40 countries have indicated an interest in joining the BRICS bloc, according to South Africa's ambassador to bloc, Anil Suklal. In the latest development, Algeria has applied to join the BRICS group and submitted a request to become a shareholder member of the NDB with an amount of $1.5 billion, Reuters reported recently.
So we can consider Sayyid Hadi Khosro Shahi.
Shahid Muhammad Baqir al-Sadr.
He was born in Kadhimiya.
The first and the most important thing that we can learn from Allama Tabatabai is his great effort.
In this regard, I should like to say that one of the great benefits of the late Ayatollah Sayyid Mahmoud Shahrudi was...
When we look at the works of late Rawzati, we see...
There is a famous sentence from Mirza Khalil Qamarani that he says in Farsi, "Tuhid kalame baraye kalame tuhid."
Be more familiar with outstanding Shia figures in The Teacher.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. Very welcome to another episode of the program The Teacher, an introduction into the thoughts and works of the most prominent Sahabi or the companions of Prophet Muhammad and the Shi'ite infallible Imams. I am Ata, the host of this program. Sheikh Rouhani and Sheikh Fadai are two guest speakers for today's discussion. Sheikh Fadai, salamu alaikum.
Salamu alaikum.
And Sheikh Rouhani, salamu alaikum to you.
Alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Today we want to talk about one of the faithful companions and Sahabi of Imam Ali alayhi salam and Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, Habib ibn Muzahir Asadi. He was from the Bani Asad tribe, and he is among the Shuhada and the martyrs of Karbala event on the day of Ashura. Sheikh Rouhani, let's start with you, brother. Give us some details about the early life of Habib ibn Muzahir Asadi.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Habib ibn Muzahir Asadi was one of the great companions of the Abu Abdullah al-Hussein alayhi salatu wassalam, as well as Imam Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali alayhi salatu wassalam and Imam Hassan al-Mujtaba alayhim alafu al-tahiyyati wassalam. So about his life, we should say that, of course, his full name is Habib. He belonged to the tribe of Asad or Asadi, and he was born, he was living in Medina and Kufa.
Yes.
Of course, he was martyred on the day of Ashura along with the companions of Abu Abdullah al-Hussein alayhi salatu wasalam, as also buried in the haram of Abu Abdullah al-Hussein alayhi salatu wasalam. And of course, Habib ibn Mazahir, about his virtues, we can mention a lot of things. One of them is that he was a very pious kind of person, a real worshipper of Almighty Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, and also one of the very, let's say, devoted companions of the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salatu wassalam.
Yes.
He narrated also lots of ahadith narrations from the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salatu wassalam, but his life at the time of the Amirul Mu'mineen is very brilliant, also particularly at the time of Abu Abdullah al-Hussein alayhi salatu wassalam. His devotion to Abu Abdullah al-Hussein alayhi salatu wassalam is also very much, we say, golden and brilliant, a part of his life that should be mentioned about him. And of course, at the time of Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salatu wassalam, he was one of the members of Shurtatul Khamis, which was like a special guard or a special force who protecting Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salatu wassalam against the enemies. They were, we can say, the most devoted people to Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salatu wassalam. That's why they were called Shurtatul Khamis.
Yes.
Yes. And later, of course, at the time of other A'imma alayhim salatu wassalam, particularly at the time of Abu Abdullah al-Hussein alayhi salatu wassalam, again, his role is very much significant, very much important. It shows that how much did he love Abu Abdullah al-Hussein alayhi salatu wassalam, that even when he was an old man, he participated in the Battle of Karbala.
Yes.
And he fought against the Yazidis, and he was martyred on the day of Ashura, together along with the Ahlul Bayt, the companions of Abu Abdullah al-Hussein alayhi salatu wassalam.
Okay, as you said, during the imamate of Imam Ali alayhi salam, he was among the first people who did bayah with Imam Ali alayhi salam, the ardent followers and the companions of Imam Ali alayhi salam. But mostly, Habib's life is linked to Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. So, was Habib from the beginning accompanying Imam al-Hussein? Or no, he was in Kufa and he was among the inviters of Imam al-Hussein to Kufa, Sheikh.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. As my brother mentioned, Habib was one of the members of Shurtatul Khamis. They were a special force who guarded Imam Ali alayhi salam. And in the time that Imam Ali migrated to Kufa, he migrated from Medina to Kufa, he accompanied Imam. So after that time, he lived in Kufa. So when Imam Hussein was in Medina, he was not in Medina. So he was in Kufa, and he was one of the people who invited Imam Hussein alayhi salam. But at the time that most of people broke their bay'ah and allegiance with Imam Hussein, he didn't do the same. He was on his bay'ah, didn't break that. And when he saw that the situation is dangerous in Kufa, in order to defend Imam, he exited Kufa at night in a way that the guards of Yazid don't know about that. He exited the city of Kufa and joined the army of Imam. So with Imam, he entered the city of Karbala. So he was in Kufa, exited Kufa and joined the army of Imam and entered Karbala. He was with Imam up to the time of his martyrdom. And it is good to know that Habib was an old man. Mm-hmm. Maybe it was not expected from Habib to participate in the battlefield, and a battle which is not a usual one. As you know, the number of people in the army of Imam was not like the number that we have in the other side. The other side, they were hundreds of thousands. But yes, in the side of Imam, there was just 72 people, of course, beside the Ahlul Bayt and their family. So they were just a few people guarding Imam, and he could say with himself that it is not my duty. I did bay'ah, and now it is not my duty to participate in this battlefield, because of his real life, he participated in the war, and it was not one of the usual fighters. He was one of the commanders of fight at the day of Ashura. Imam Hussein appointed him as the commander of the left wing, left side of the army. So he was a commander at that age. And it is mentioned that on the day, at the night of Ashura, before Ashura, the night before that day, he heard that Lady Zainab is so worried about that, about the day of Ashura. And she's worried that Imam Hussein is alone. When he heard that, Habib gathered all the companions and they went to Lady Zainab, and they guaranteed that they defend Imam Hussein up to their death. They don't allow Imam to be alone. So this is the real position of Habib, a warrior, a brave one, and of course he was one of the scholars of our Shiite belief.
That's right. When the people pay visit to the holy shrine of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam in Karbala, they also pay visit to Habib ibn Muzahir's shrine, which is maybe not far away from that, okay? A little bit chamber, just in vicinity of the tomb of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir. La ilaha illallah.
La ilaha illallah.
Okay, Sheikh Rouhani, you give us some details and about the picture of Habib ibn Muzahir. Along with Muslim al-Saja, he was among the people who left Kufa in a secretive way to join Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam and his army on the day of Ashura, and finally they were both martyred.
About Habib ibn Muzahir, there are lots of nice points and interesting points that could be mentioned. One of them is that Habib ibn Muzahir knew something secret. He had ilm al-manaya, which is said that he knew something unseen, like secrets.
Yes.
He learned them from Ahl al-Bayt, alayhim salatu wasalam. One of them is that is mentioned in the history is a dialogue, a conversation between Habib ibn Muzahir and Maytham Tammar.
Okay.
Which is very interesting.
Very good. What is the story?
Yeah, the story is this, that in this conversation, they talk about the way that they will die. They knew, both of them knew, how will they die or how will they be martyred. Later, what happened to Habib ibn Muzahir and as well as Maysam ibn Tammar was exactly the things that were mentioned in their conversation years before the event of Ashura.
Oh.
So it was the thing that they knew about themselves.
They were given this news by the Imam.
By the Ahl
al-Bayt,
of course, by Amir al-Mu'minin Ali alayhi salatu wassalam. Yes, and also when it comes to the event of Ashura, there are very nice scenes or let's say points that should be mentioned here. One of them is that Habib ibn Muzahir once convinced the enemies of Abu Abdullah al-Hussein alayhi salatu wasalam on the evening of the day of Tasu'a, because on the day of Tasu'a they decided to attack the tents of Ahl al-Bayt alayhi salatu wasalam. It was Habib ibn Muzahir who talked to them and convinced them not to attack on the day of Tasu'a. During the night of Ashura, again, one of the very, very important thing that was done by Habib ibn Muzahir was this, that some of the companions of Abu Abdullah alayhi salatu wasalam told Habib ibn Muzahir that Lady Zainab salamullahi alayha is very much worried about Abu Abdullah alayhi salatu wasalam, about the day of Ashura, which would be the next day. And then Habib ibn Muzahir gathered the companions of Abu Abdullah al-Hussein alayhi salatu wasalam and told them that, okay, we should talk to about Abdullah al-Husayn alayhi salatu wasalam, because Lady Zainab sallallahu alayha is very much worried about the Day of Ashura, and it is one of the very golden event of Ashura, which happened at the night of Ashura by Habib ibn Muzahir, and he gathered the companions of Abdullah al-Husayn alayhi salatu wasalam to tell Zainab that we are with Abu Abdullah and you shouldn't be worried about the day of Ashura.
That's right.
These are the things that are mentioned in the history, which shows the great role of Habib.
That's right.
On the event of Ashura.
That's right. Thank you very much, Sheikh Rouhani. Even the name of Habib ibn Muzahir is mentioned in the Ziyarah text of Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam, which is read out on Sha'ban 15th. This shows the great significance. And Sheikh Fadai, he is buried just not very much close to the other shuhada of Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam. Do you know the reason?
Yes, you know, Habib was from a tribe called Bani Asad, as it was mentioned. And in the time that Imam Husayn reached Karbala, Habib asked Imam that I can call some people in order to help you, because Bani Asad live near to Karbala.
Yes.
By the permission of Imam Husayn, he went to his tribe. He was one of the great people of Bani Asad, Muslim ibn Usajj and Habib ibn Muzahir. Both of them were some of the great people of Bani Asad. He went to his tribe and asked them to help Imam Husayn, and all the tribe accepted that. And they started to go to the battlefield, but this news reached to the army of Yazid, and they made an obstacle. They didn't allow. You know, they sent an army to the Bani Asad, and they didn't allow that tribe to reach Imam Husayn. They couldn't go to a battlefield of Ashura.
Yes.
But when they heard Bani Asad, when they heard the news of martyrdom of Imam Husayn, they started to, they reached to the city of Karbala. They went there. So the burial ceremony of Imam Husayn and other martyrs of Karbala was done by this tribe. Imam Sajjad came to Karbala, of course, by a miracle, because it was not a normal journey. Imam Sajjad came to Karbala by miracle and helped Bani Asad. Why? Because Bani Asad didn't know who are these bodies. The bodies didn't have any heads.
That's right.
So Imam Sajjad knew all of the bodies.
Yes.
He helped them to bury the corpse of the Ashura martyrs.
Yes.
So there was a grave for Imam Husayn and Ali Akbar and Ali Asghar, and other one for all of the martyrs of Karbala. But because Habib ibn Muzahir was one of their head, the head of their tribe.
The tribes, that's right.
Because of his position, Bani Asad decided to bury him in a different place.
Different place,
you know, in order to know the place of their head. So because of that, he has a different tomb, and people go to his ziyarah,
that's right,
and he is beloved by all Shia.
That's right. Although he was old, he struggled hard on the day of Ashura. 62, they say, persons out of the enemy army of the enemy were killed by this man. Finally, so many people surrounded him, you know, that's right, with the swords, you know, they attacked him, they killed him, they beheaded him. When Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam reached the body of Habib ibn Muzahir, he said that, "I ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala for a great reward for you and your supporters." Also, it is mentioned that Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam has said that Habib was a virtuous man who could recite the whole Quran during the night. And as we said, the name of Habib ibn Muzahir is named the Ziyarah text of Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam. The famous conversation between Habib ibn Muzahir and Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam about the creation of human beings before Adam, you know, and the questions that he asked from Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam, Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam referring to the Khilgat al-Nuri, or the light for creation of the Imams, is really outstanding. I invite our dear listeners to refer to this conversation, which refers to the, we can say, lightful creation of the holy Imams and Prophet Muhammad.
Thank you very much, Sheikh Badai and Sheikh Rouhani, for a nice elaboration regarding the life account of Habib ibn Muzahir. We again express our condolences on the martyrdom anniversary of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam and his faithful companions on the day of Ashura 61 AH to our dear Muslims all around the world. For more information and for listening to our special programs in the month of Muharram, visit our website at parstoday.ir, Call of Islam page. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
In the limelight.
The U.S. bases abroad are not just a pain for local residents, but also a political problem for the host countries. What comes with the U.S. military bases is not peace and security, but clouds of war and endless fear. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. China Daily wrote, "We were forced to fight for a long time, hoping that people would understand our situation. Under the hot sun, dozens of residents on the Japanese island of Okinawa held signs expressing their anger at the United States military base there. Every day, there is a large number of military aircraft training at the U.S. military base in Okinawa. To the local people, the loud noise generated by various military equipment is not only unbearable, but also causing health problems such as sleep disorder. However, the U.S. authorities do not seem to care about what local people think. Actually, they don't need to, since the U.S. forces in Japan are not subject to Japanese jurisdiction. Local people's concerns are all in vain. Protests by local Japanese have been going on for more than a decade. Over the years, American troops based on this island have committed countless crimes." According to the statistics of the Okinawa Police, from 1972 to 2020, U.S. troops committed 6,000 crimes in the local area, and 1 in 10 was serious. A series of sexual assaults by U.S. troops in Japan in 2016 sparked widespread outrage among local people. But the journey to upholding justice and punishing the criminals is too long to embark on. The complex litigation process often makes victimized local women swallow their pride. According to survey results, the prosecution rate of crimes committed by U.S. troops in Japan is less than 20%. Even if the victims won the case, the compensation will be mostly borne by the Japanese government, and the U.S. authorities will do little. According to statistics by the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft, a U.S.-based think tank, the U.S. has 750 overseas military bases in 80 countries, which host a large number of U.S. troops all year around, costing more than $55 billion a year. Not long ago, the New York Times published an article titled "A Brutal Sex Trade for American Soldiers" that exposed the suffering of Korean women at U.S. military bases in Korea in 1980s with the connivance and even assistance of the South Korean government. About 19,000 South Korean women were sexually exploited by the U.S. troops in its host country, and many of the victims still live with memories of fear and humiliation. The U.S. bases abroad are not just a pain for local residents, but also a political problem for the host countries. What comes with the U.S. military bases is not peace and security, but clouds of war and endless fear. Over the decades, the U.S. has continued to wage military strikes and even wars of aggression from its overseas military bases against other sovereign countries with different political views. From Latin America to the West Asia region, from East Asia to Eastern Europe. With the help of its global military bases, the United States was behind almost every major military conflict since the Second World War. Earlier this year, the Pentagon announced a deal with the Philippines that it will add 4 more military bases in this country. Some worried that this marks a return to 1980s, when the Philippines was home to 15,000 U.S. troops and 2 of the largest American military bases in Asia. Renato Reyes, Secretary General of New Patriotic Alliance, said, "We have a long history of inequality in our relationship. The Philippines has been forced to shoulder the social cost. There is a history of rape, child abuse, and of toxic waste." The U.S. action was also criticized for escalating regional tension and undermining regional peace and stability in the Asia-Pacific. The worldwide military bases of the United States have not made the world or even the U.S. any safer. The U.S. needs to stop finding excuses to further expand its military hegemony and drag the world into more conflicts. The biggest threat to world peace and stability is none other than the United States itself. Also, the website of Axios reported, on May 14, 2023, thousands of protesters gathered near Kadena Air Base in Okinawa to call for the closure of U.S. military bases on the Japanese island. The annual protests come as Okinawa is increasingly at the center of a possible superpower showdown in the Pacific. The island's location, just a 1-hour flight east of Taiwan, makes it key to any U.S. military response if China were to attack Taiwan. Protesters chanted, "Give us back our peaceful life," and "Osprey, get out," a reference to the military helicopters often seen in the skies over the island. A U.S. Marines spokesperson on the island did not respond to a request for comment. The United States military has had an extensive presence on the island since 1945 and occupied it until 1972, when it was returned to Japanese sovereignty. Chemical contamination in areas close to the bases, noise pollution, and crimes committed by U.S. servicemen, including rape, have in the past enraged the population and sparked massive protests. Protesters told Axios that they feel they have long been forced to bear a disproportionate burden of U.S.-Japan military alliance. Okinawa makes up less than 1% of Japan's total land area, but hosts more than 70% of all U.S. military facilities in Japan.
Thank you. We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
This is A to Z. An introduction into Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, how to remain steadfast, especially when looking at Imam Hussein alayhi salam. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, it is such an honor to be here at your service, dear listeners, dear friends. In today's episode, we are talking about how to remain steadfast, especially when taking into consideration Imam Hussein alayhi salam. Now, from the title, you have already guessed, because it is quite clear that one of the things that we learn from Imam Hussein alayhi salam is this steadfastness. Now, to remain on the path of Islam and to really live an Islamic lifestyle, you know, we're going to have to be steadfast. Now, being steadfast means that, you know, despite trials or tribulations, despite challenges and despite difficulties that might arise in trying to be a good person, in trying to be an honorable individual, and in trying to live this beautiful Islamic lifestyle, that we will, despite all these things, we will continue to be steadfast and continue to live an Islamic lifestyle, right? So when we look at Imam Hussein alayhi salam and the land of Karbala and the 10th of Muharram and even the events leading up to the 10th of Muharram in the year 61 Hijri, where the Master of Martyrs himself was martyred and attained martyrdom, but also 72 of his companions, among others, were martyred for the cause of Allah, on the path of Allah, they remained steadfast throughout all of these challenges and these difficulties. And it is a believer who is faced with challenges, it is a mu'min, it is a faithful person who is faced with challenges in order to test their belief, right? Even the Holy Quran says, do you think that you will acclaim and you will attest to faith, but you won't be tested to that proclamation that you make that you are of the faithful? Now, of course, the reward of the faithful is great, and we call ourselves faithful. So should there not be a test in order to gauge whether we are faithful or not?
Why is my heart set on fire when I hear your name?
As-salamu alayk, ya Aba Abdullah.
Welcome back. This is A to Z on IRIB English Radio. So we're talking about how to be steadfast, and that too when taking into consideration Imam Hussein alayhi salam. So as we said, if we want to live an Islamic lifestyle in an environment which is relatively, if not totally, un-Islamic, then we're going to have to be steadfast. We're going to have to remain strong and confident. And this is something that we ourselves need to understand, that the Islamic lifestyle that we have been prescribed by the Almighty Allah is a perfect lifestyle. It is a perfect order. And not only does it bring about bliss and prosperity and satisfaction and joy, on a personal, individual level, but it will also do the same on a family level, as well as a communal, community level, social level, as well as eventually the global level, which is the ultimate purpose. The ultimate purpose is to bring happiness and bring prosperity and bring bliss and tranquility to all of humanity. And so in order to live an Islamic lifestyle, because that's where it all starts, right, is the individuals in a society, in a community, in a family, living an Islamic lifestyle. Well, we're going to have to be steadfast on that Islamic lifestyle. And just like Imam Hussein alayhi salam has taught us, we are going to face challenges and we're going to face difficulties. But if we rely on the Almighty Allah, if we have faith in the Almighty Allah and we trust the Almighty Allah, then, of course, with a little bit of effort on our part, or perhaps a lot of effort and remaining steadfast, we will be able to live that Islamic lifestyle. Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of A to Z. Don't forget to visit our website at parsetoday.ir/EN Call of Islam page, where you can find all of our previous programs and many others as well. Until another episode, fi amanillah and God bless you all. But anyone stay here won't be alive tomorrow. You can save yourself tonight and go at tea. Silence, fill the air.
In the limelight. China has repeatedly warned against the establishment of an Asia-Pacific version of NATO, making it clear its opposition to any foreign military involvement in the region. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. Daily News Hungary has covered this story and tells us more. Hungary's Prime Minister Viktor Orban has sounded the alarm bell about an inevitable war to take place between Washington and Beijing, as the United States is reluctant to accept China's supremacy. The Daily cited Viktor Orban as speaking at a venue in Transylvania, Romania, on Saturday, 22nd of July. Orban said, "The United States does not accept the fact that China has overtaken it in many sectors of industry." He added, "The United States does not accept the fact that it has become the world's second most powerful nation after China." The outspoken Hungarian Prime Minister said China was in a deep slumber for hundreds of years, but woke up and managed to develop as much in 30 years as other countries have done in the past 200 years. Viktor Orban said, due to development and technological advancements, the Chinese nation now claims its place under the sun. He added, however, Washington does not accept such quick development. As a result, a clash between the two world powers is inevitable. Tensions between the United States and China have significantly escalated, particularly over the issue of Taiwan and the South China Sea. Despite publicly recognizing China's sovereignty over Taiwan under the One China policy, the United States continues to remain the island's most important international supporter and supplier of arms, a source of constant tension between Washington and Beijing. The United States has created the Quad Partnership with India, Japan, and Australia, in addition to the AUKUS Alliance, also with Australia, alongside the United Kingdom. Both U.S. pacts are intended to strengthen the ability of each government to support security and defense interests in the form of a military NATO-like alliance. China has repeatedly warned the United States against the expansionist foreign policy. Earlier this month, Beijing opposed NATO's eastward expansion, viewing it as a threat by the U.S.-led NATO military alliance to further intrude into the Asia-Pacific region. China has vowed to firmly respond to any threat against its legitimate rights in the Asia-Pacific. The warning came in a statement issued by China's mission to the European Union following a NATO summit in the Lithuanian capital Vilnius on 12th of July, where the US-led Western military alliance lashed out at Beijing, accusing China of challenging NATO members' interests, security and values. In response, Beijing asserted the Chinese government will firmly defend its national sovereignty, security and interests against any threats from the United States. The India Times has also covered the same story and tells us more. The United States and Australia rehearsed precision missile strikes during war games on Saturday, 22nd of July, the latest in a series of moves by the partners amid growing tensions with China in the Indo-Pacific region. The live fire drills were held at the Shoalwater Bay military complex in the northeastern region of Queensland as part of a two-week-long Talisman Sabre joint military exercises. It comes as Canberra overhauls its military strategy, focusing on long-range firepower in a bid to purportedly keep the potential adversaries at arm's length. Major Jimmy Sheehan, Talisman Sabre spokesperson for United States forces, said, "These initiatives and first ultimately create an exercise that will enhance Australia and America's ability to respond to global security challenges in this region." The U.S. Secretary of Navy, Carlos Del Toro, claimed at the start of the exercises on Friday, 21st of July, that the most important message that China can take from this exercise and anything that our allies and partners do together is that we are extremely tied by the core values that exist amongst our many nations. Meanwhile, Lieutenant General Greg Bilton, Australia's Chief of Joint Operations, claimed that a Chinese spy ship has been sighted off the northeastern coast of Australia while preparations for the military exercises were underway. On Saturday, 22nd of July, the US commissioned the Independent Class Littoral Combat Ship, named USS Canberra, at a ceremony at an Australian naval base in Sydney Harbour, officially joining the US Navy's active fleet. China has repeatedly warned against the establishment of an Asia-Pacific version of NATO and made clear its opposition to any foreign military involvement in the region. The warning came in response to a communique made at a NATO summit in Vilnius, Lithuania on 12th of July, alleging that China's hybrid and cyber operations and its confrontational rhetoric and disinformation target allies and harm alliance security. China said the NATO communique distorts China's position and policies, adding that the Western military alliance's activities will inevitably undermine regional peace and stability. China's Global Times has also covered the same story and tells us more. China and Russia have begun joint naval and air drills in the Sea of Japan, aimed at strengthening cooperation between the two countries' navies and maintaining peace and stability in the Asia-Pacific region. Russia's Defense Ministry said in a statement on Thursday, 20th of July, that the four-day joint military exercises, dubbed Northern Interaction 2023, will be held from 20th to 23rd of July as scheduled, in accordance with the International Military Cooperation Plan. The statement said the two countries' naval forces will practice conducting joint anti-submarine warfare and naval combat maneuvers. It added they will carry out sea and air convoys of ships, protect and defend groups of ships when moored in an unprotected estuary, and ensure the security of communications in the waters and airspace of the Sea of Japan. According to the Russian Defense Ministry, joint artillery firing is also planned during the Russia-Chinese military exercises. The latest drills come as the two countries have pledged to deepen their military cooperation. China and Russia have agreed to expand trade, energy and political relations amid the West's increasingly adversarial approach over the war in Ukraine. Washington has become more vigilant about relations between Beijing and Moscow ever since Chinese President Xi Jinping and Russian President Vladimir Putin struck a new limits partnership back in February of 2022. China has blamed the United States and NATO for provoking Moscow over the Ukraine war and has condemned Western sanctions against Russia. Russia has also strongly backed China amid the recent tensions between Beijing and Washington over the U.S. political and military interference in Taiwan. The United States claims Washington's anti-Beijing measures aim to protect U.S. interests. During her recent visit to China, U.S. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen confirmed that the two sides will continue to have disagreements in this regard. Janet Yellen said, "The United States will, in certain circumstances, need to pursue targeted action to protect its national security. And we may disagree in these instances." Among the measures targeting Chinese firms, the U.S. back in October announced sweeping export controls that restrict the ability of Chinese businesses to develop advanced semiconductors. Also recently, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken visited Beijing. Blinken's visit came after China's top military officials continued to refuse to hold talks with their American counterparts in recent months, citing U.S. sanctions imposed against Beijing and senior Chinese officials as an obstacle to maintaining cordial relations between Beijing and Washington. Today, 9th of Muharram, is the day of Tasua, the day before the heart-rending tragedy of Ashura. We here at RIB English Radio express our heartfelt condolences to all our Muslim listeners throughout the world on the occasion of Tasua.
Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
The viewpoints of the leader of the Islamic Republic of Iran, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, about Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam and the tragedy of Karbala. It is narrated that after Imam al-Sajjad alayhi salam returned to Medina from Karbala, maybe 10 or 11 months passes between the time this caravan left Medina and returned, a person visited him and said, O son of the Messenger of Allah, you see, you went and what happened? He was right. The caravan had left while Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, the bright son of Ahlul Bayt, so much loved by the Messenger of Allah, was among them, leading them. The daughter of Imam Ali alayhi salam had left while she was dignified and honored. The children of Imam Ali alayhi salam, Abbas and others, the children of Imam Hassan al-Mushtaba, prominent and talented youths of Bani Hashem, had all left with this caravan. But the caravan returned with only one man, Imam al-Sajjad alayhi salam, with the women gone through sufferings of captivity and the loss of their loved ones. Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, Hazrat Ali al-Akbar, and even the baby were now gone. Imam al-Sajjad alayhi salam answered that man stating, imagine what would have happened if we had not gone. Yes, if they had not gone, their bodies might have survived, but the truth would have died. The soul would have died out. Consciences would have been shattered. Logic and reason would have been condemned throughout history. And even the name of Islam would not have remained.
Ana mazlum Hussein, ana mazlum Hussein, ana mazlum Hussein, ana mazlum Hussein, ana latshan.
Imam Hussein, peace be upon him, made the army of reason overcome the army of ignorance.
Why did Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam take his family to Karbala? Why didn't he refuse to fight with several thousand fighter army of Yazid in spite of having only 72 people in his army? Why didn't he try other methods? Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam brought his dear ones to the desert of Karbala in order to clarify the truth. He knew what was going to happen, yet he brought Zainab, his wives, his children, and his brothers with him. Like the day of Mubahala, it was again a matter of clarifying the truth and promoting Islam in the real sense of the word. That shows the importance of promoting Islam.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all.
Of Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
سید امین‌عالمی، کابل.
شاهان بات، ایندین ادمنیسترد کشمیر.
Round the world with reporters.
Representatives of religious minorities have met in the Iranian capital Tehran to condemn the desecration of Muslims' holy book Quran, saying that such a sacrilegious act is aimed at creating discord and division among followers of different religious beliefs. They condemned repeated desecrations of the Holy Quran and Islamic sanctities in Sweden, noting that the Swedish government is fully responsible for the consequences of provoking the sentiments of the Muslim world.
Such insults to Islamic sanctities are a perfect example of organized violence in a hostile move against 2 billion Muslims across the world, God-believing people and followers of divine religions. Desecration of religious sanctities is rejected in all faiths. The recent desecrations in Sweden is considered a heinous crime and is unacceptable.
The recurring incidents of the desecration of Islamic sanctities in Europe, particularly in Sweden and Denmark, have drawn outrage across the Muslim world in recent weeks, especially here in Iran. In the Iranian capital Tehran, demonstrators gathered in front of the Swedish embassy to protest against the sacrilegious move. Moreover, millions of people took to the streets in Tehran and other major cities after Friday prayers this week to voice their anger over the incidents in Sweden and Denmark.
The sins or plot hatched by the enemies of Islam is not limited only to this period of time. The enemies of divine religions have always tried to sow the seeds of discord among their followers. But they should know that followers of Islam and other divine religions are vigilant and will not allow such insulting acts to create division and discord among them, and they get even more united in the face of the enemies.
Any insult to religious sanctities and divine books anywhere by anyone is deplorable. Any freedom of speech which is meant to violate the dignity, values, and religious sanctities of good and God-loving people is not freedom of speech and has no value and is strongly condemned.
Muslim protesters have demanded punishment for the perpetrators, calling for the boycott of Swedish and Danish products. Representatives of divine religions here believe that branding such moves as acts of democracy and freedom will only further fuel terrorism and extremism across the world, the consequences of which will boomerang on the West before any other side. Salman Kujuri, Tehran.
Handcuffed and humiliated before her child for the offense she didn't commit. A black woman arrested for what the Metropolitan Police in London suspected was a bus fare evasion. They were wrong. She was released. What ensued? Widespread outrage from the public and politicians. Claudia Webb, MP, said the Met Police is the boot of the state. They do not care about black people and black women in particular. The incident has reignited national conversations about institutional racism and misogyny within the British police force, a force grappling with a crisis of confidence. Revelations of criminals within its ranks, including Wayne Cousins, who abducted, raped, and murdered Sarah Everard as she was walking home nearly 2 years ago, and David Carrick, who admitted to dozens of sexual offenses against 12 women, have shaken faith in the force.
Policing in the UK relies on public consent and trust, but confidence in the police has been in decline in the past few years, especially when it comes to racism against minorities and violence against women and girls. And with the continuing disclosures of members of the police found guilty in those crimes, it's only exposing how deep the problems run.
Of all minority communities, black Britons say they feel the least safe at the hands of British police. The strip search of Child Q, a black 15-year-old girl suspected of having marijuana at a London school in 2020 by two female officers without another adult present, and the police killing of Chris Baba last September, a 24-year-old father and aspiring rapper, are two recent examples.
This case of this young mother with her child is actually symptomatic of the degree of systemic and culturally ingrained racism within the Metropolitan Police Service. And it's a tale that I hear from black mothers all over the city consistently about their unprofessional, violent, and sometimes racist treatment at the hands of them and their children at the hands of the Metropolitan Police Service.
Black children are 11 times more likely to be strip searched in England and Wales than their white peers. And more than half stopped and searched by the police say they were left with feelings of humiliation or embarrassment.
Trauma is a real lived and everyday experience for black people in terms of their relationship with policing, whether it's stop and search, whether it's violent arrest. Again, by the Met's own standards, the Home Office's own figures, you're more likely to be stop and search, you're more likely to be violent arrested. And what we find is the trauma that's inflicted on the individuals in communities is completely unrecognized and ignored.
Restoring trust would be a massive undertaking. Some are calling for the force to be disbanded in the wake of the recent scandals. Others say the promised overhaul of the UK's entire police culture may be just one step to restore some measure of